Acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 90, Indigo No. Sunday, September 20th, 2015. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. You can find show notes on my website, yarnsatyinhu.com. And for this episode, there is quite an extensive array of show notes and photographs. Today's episode includes the following segments: The Back Porch, Sheep to Shawl, Ever Expanding Skill Set, and so forth. Thank you to everyone who has said hello over the past 2 weeks. It's been 2 weeks since my last recording. And many folks have introduced themselves on the introductions thread on Ravelry, and quite a few new folks have joined the group. We're still not at 500 members, so hopefully by the next recording, I will be able to do a drawing for the $25 Etsy gift certificate. I will randomly select one post from the introductions thread. So in order to be in the running for the prize, you need to join the group and introduce yourself on the welcome thread. If you haven't already join the group on Ravelry. And if you haven't introduced yourself, please say hello. There are quite a few introductions, so I'm going to be saving all of those for the end of the episode this week. By way of welcome, I would like to share a poem that is new to me, but is quickly becoming a favorite. In your welcome posts, many of you have been telling me a little bit about things you enjoy on the podcast, and several folks have mentioned poetry, even asked some questions about my sources for poetry. One of the best, in my opinion, is a website called the Poetry Foundation website. They have an extensive and very easily searchable database of poems and information about poets, poetry movements, etc. On iTunes, you can also find a number of podcasts that are issued by the Poetry Foundation. They're typically brief, so it's something that's easy to digest in a small amount of time. And usually these podcasts are focused on accessible poetry or in making something that might be a little bit less accessible, easier to understand. So I find them very inviting. I have a degree in poetry, and these are the kind of podcasts that I enjoy and still learn something from as I enjoy them. So I think that the tone and the approach that the Poetry Foundation takes in educating folks about poetry and then providing them with poetry to enjoy is really spot on, in my opinion. A lot of my summer and fall activity is focused on sitting and working on my porch and watching all the activity on the creek below. There's starting to be quite a bit of leaf fall. It's been an extremely dry end of summer here, and so there's not going to be spectacular color, I don't suppose, but leaves are already starting to shrivel and fall from the trees, and there is this beautiful, calm, glassy surface of the creek in some parts, and one of my favorite visitors is the great blue heron. This poem is titled Once. It's by Tara Bray, and I do provide a link to it and all of the things that I'm going to mention today in the show notes on my blog. Once. I climbed the roll of hay to watch the heron in the pond. He waded a few steps out, then back, thrusting his beak underwater, pulling it up empty. But only once. Later, I walked the roads for miles, certain he'd be there when I returned. How is it for him day after day, his brittle legs rising from warm, green scum, his graceful neck curled damp in the bright heat? It's a dull world. Every day, the same roads, the sky, the dust, the barn caving into itself, the tin roof twisted and scattered in the yard. Again, the bank covered with oxeye daisy that turns to spiderwort, to chicory, and at last to goldenrod. Each year the birds, thick in the air and darting in wild numbers, grow quiet. The grass is thin. The light leaves earlier each day. The heron stood stone still on my spot when I returned. And then his wings burst open, lifting the steel-blue rhythm of his body into flight. I touched the warm hay, hoping for a trace of his wild smell. I cupped my hands over my face. Nothing but the heat of fields and skin. It wasn't long before the world began to breathe the beat of ordinary hours, stretching out again beneath the sky. The asymmetrical, or asymmetrical, craft along continues until the end of September. There are several fantastic prizes for folks who finish an asymmetrical garment or accessory by the end of the month, including 2 project bags, 2 books. There's a skein of yarn hand-dyed with cochineal dye, beautiful tonal red. And this week, I'd like to announce the addition of a sock pattern. It's the Agatha sock pattern by Claire. Claire is host of the New Hampshire Knits podcast, and Agatha is her first published pattern. So congratulations, Claire, on your pattern and on your 1-year podiversary. And thank you for your generous offer of a pattern for a Yarns at Yinhu listener and asymmetrical crafter. Photographs of all prizes, links to the generous contributors, and complete information about the contest are found on Ravelry. The back porch. Since recording my last episode, I have begun and completed another iteration of the Outlander cowl, a pattern by Andy Fagan. For this pattern, I used some handspun that I've just been looking at it on my shelf for months and months and wanting to knit with this beautiful Polwarth handspun dyed, expertly dyed in aubergine by the lovely Patrizia of BZB Fibers. I purchased this fiber, spun it up right away, and it's a beautiful color transition from brown to a deep purple, an eggplant sort of purple. And then that kind of bleeds out a little bit so that the purple becomes a bit pinkish. And then there are amazing greens. And finally, the creamy, lemony color that can be the flesh inside an eggplant when you slice it open. So this was a simple 2-ply yarn. I think I had just over 400 yards. And I had knit another cowl, the Outlander cowl by Andy Fagan, with some handspun before. And so I repeated my approach in that I did not do the textured stitches in the beginning of the pattern. The first portion of this cowl is simply stockinette stitch, which shows off the handspun beautifully. And then there's this lovely ribbed lace. It's very, very simple to execute, but it has high impact, I think. It looks striking. And then there are incredibly clear instructions for moving from the lace pattern straight into a ribbed border. There's also an alternative garter stitch border. But I liked the rib border because I liked the way that the lace and the diagonal shift of the lace just transitions seamlessly into a ribbed edging. And then there are very clear instructions for binding off in the ribbed pattern. I had forgotten that those details were so informative in the pattern, and so I really appreciated that when I was knitting it this time. Maybe this time that technique will stick with me. I don't know. I used US size 7 bamboo needles, which were just a really nice, inviting, relaxing experience to knit with the handspun. And I kept thinking as I was knitting that my handspun was a Polwarth silk blend because it just seems so silky and soft. But no, it's 100% Polwarth, and boy, is it just beautiful. It's very light, but it's incredibly warm. I'm not sure whether this will be a gift or something I keep. It is so, so pretty. If you're looking for some spinning fiber that is expertly dyed, I highly recommend a visit to Patricia's shop on Etsy. It's called Beezy Bee. Right now, she does have another colorway of transitionally dyed fiber. I guess some would call it a gradient, but it's not really a gradient of the same color. It's fiber that transitions through 3 or 4 colors. So that could be a really satisfying spin. She also has a colorway called, I think it's called Mango Chocolate Chili. It looks scrumptious. So check her out, Patricia of BZB Fibers. And I also recommend very highly the Outlander Cowl by Andy Fagan. It's expertly written. It's suitable for a very wide range of yarns. The instructions are suited for fingering weight, and then I think also DK and worsted weight yarn. So there's a lot of variety and flexibility in the pattern, and easy to follow instructions as well. Sheep to Shawl. Last Saturday, I spent the day at Fibercraft Studio with my Sheep to Shawl classmates, and the day was focused on dyeing with indigo and weld. These are both natural dyes, plant-based dyes that yield bluish dye. And I was mostly interested in this and heavily invested in this process because I've been carefully tending some Japanese indigo through the hot, dry summer, and I really wanted to repeat the dyeing process at home so that it would enhance my learning experience, but also just for the satisfaction of dying with something that I have grown. And so the day started early with a trip into the dye garden at the Threefold Center, and our class picked indigo leaves and also picked a bunch of weld. And then we went back to the dye studio and we washed the leaves. The indigo leaves were incredibly clean. So I was working with the weld group. I'm not sure if the indigo folks even washed their leaves, but the weld grows much lower to the ground and was dusty and muddy. And so we needed to rinse the leaves, remove the roots, just keep the leaf portion. And then both kinds of leaves were shredded into the smallest pieces possible. And this is to expose as much surface area as you can. Once this was completed, we added water to the two pots and then brought the liquid to a simmer and then kept that simmering for about an hour to extract the properties from the plant. We used thick rubber gloves to squeeze as much of the liquid from the leaves as possible. Those can be saved and used for a second dye bath that yields a less vibrant color. But as you'll find out, I think that would be kind of a futile exercise. I don't know, maybe if you kept a lot of spent leaves, you would have enough to work with that would actually yield color. Soda ash or washing soda is added to make the liquid alkaline. And then the liquid is poured from pot to pot after this washing soda has been added in order to aerate the liquid or expose the surface area of the liquid to the air. And with this process, the liquid, which starts as kind of a sherry colored brownish liquid, begins to foam and turn a blue or greenish blue color. There are some photographs on my blog. I spent quite a bit of time pouring the liquid from pot to pot, and what you see pictured is the weld pot, which I think was the most successful of the two, the more successful of the two, because through this aeration process, it really foamed up and there is a distinct blue tinge to that foam. In order to stabilize that solution, we added just a bit of thiourea dioxide. And this is a powdered version of, I guess, what you would have if you added fermented urine to the dye vat. It makes a very stinky aroma, and the liquid is warmed back up again because throughout the aeration process, it really has a chance to cool down. So it's brought back to a gentle simmer and then kept covered, and it's ready for use as a dye bath. So we dyed, folks dyed all manner of things. There is no mordant necessary with an indigo or weld dye bath. So we had some washed locks. People were dyeing felt. I had some combed top because I had spun up and dyed up almost all of the other fiber that I took home with me over the summer. And the method is to submerge the fiber and keep the pot covered as much as possible. Let the fiber soak in that dye bath for maybe 20 to 45 seconds. Then with thick rubber gloves, you squeeze the dye from the fiber while it is submerged. And then you remove it and expose it to the air. And that's when you can see the color gradually take hold. And it turns a bluish, a very pale robin's egg sort of blue was the color that we were getting from the weld dye pot. And then something even more subtle from the indigo dye pot. So the blue color emerges with the air exposure, and then after allowing the fiber to cool and rest for maybe 15 minutes or so, you can repeat the process and see if you can get a deeper, richer color. I thought this was just a magical process, and of course I couldn't wait to get home and try that out with my own indigo. So I had soda ash because I've been making my own washing soda, I guess, from baking soda, which you can do by just baking it in a 400-degree oven. But I ordered some thyrea dioxide from an online source, so I would have that. And then I picked all of the leaves off of my indigo plants. It yielded about, I don't know, a few ounces, I suppose. The leaves are rather small and light, and I shredded them very carefully, and I packed them into a glass jar. This was the method we used at Fibercraft Studio for the indigo bath. It was almost like a bain-marie or a water bath of the indigo and some water in a jar, and then that was placed in a large pot filled with water. And what that does is it protects the indigo from temperature extremes that you might get by just, you know, putting the indigo in the water and cooking that in the pot. So that method worked very successfully at Fibercraft Studio. However, the bottom of my 2-quart mason jar broke while it was in the water bath, and the indigo and the filtered water I had inside the jar mixed together with the immense amount of unfiltered water I had in the pot. And that solution was just so diluted because I didn't have that much indigo in the first place that the entire experiment went down the tubes. So I learned that a technique I see successfully executed by experts may not work for me. I probably should have taken measures to protect the bottom of the jar from the bottom of the pot, even though that jar was sitting directly on the bottom of the pot at Fibercraft Studio. No problems whatsoever. No broken jar. I probably should have protected my jar from the bottom of the pot. So I can just look forward to next month, when we will be doing some indigo dyeing with powdered indigo, which I think will yield a more vibrant blue. And I also look forward to tending some indigo in my garden next summer as well. I still have the plants and they do regrow their leaves. However, I think maybe we're too late into the growing season right now for it to yield much in the way of leaves. I have been tending the plant, so maybe I'll be able to get enough leaves to give that a try again. I can also let this plant go to seed, save some of those seeds, and then I can germinate those myself and start some seedlings inside this winter. Also, each spring, Fibercraft Studio has a big fundraiser event, and they sell some young indigo plants, which is how I purchased the ones that I've had this summer. All in all, I'm glad I had the experience. I'm glad I gave it a try, even though it ended up being somewhat disappointing. My intense fondness for my instructors at Fibercraft Studio and just the whole program they run there continues to deepen. I can't recommend their classes and their products more heartily. They will be, as they always are, in a booth at Rhinebeck this October. And they're located in the two-story barn. Last year, Ross Farms was on the upper level. So if you're familiar with where that is, you know the barn. And Fibercraft Studio typically has a booth in the lower level of that barn. So you walk up directly into the barn and they are facing you along that back wall. I will be helping out at the booth and volunteering some of my time each afternoon. I'm thinking maybe between, 2 and 4 or something like that. That could change depending on when I'm needed, but I hope you stop by and say hello and consider purchasing some of the exquisitely dyed yarns that are available at the booth. And there are also incredible designs that you can receive when you purchase the yarn for garments and accessories that they're just amazing. The attention to soft, natural, feminine detail is incredible. So it's really worth a look. Ever-expanding skill set. Thanks to everyone who has been posting suggestions, ideas, and links for lunchboxes and healthy lunches in our Power Pantry thread this month. We've devoted the month of September to thinking about how our effective culinary preparations can yield a tastier and healthier lunch. I often feel uninspired when it's time to prepare my lunch for work, and it's been great to hear a lot of suggestions. One that I will be using in this coming week is the idea of rice bowls for lunch and making a very large batch of rice. I like to make mine a little bit more exciting with coconut milk as a substitution for part of the liquid, or chicken stock, maybe curry powder. I like to put some nuts and raisins into my rice and make it a kind of pilaf. Then it's a great background for leftover vegetables or even fresh and dried vegetables. This week I had some leftover crispy kale from a recipe that I made, and then I added some sun-dried tomatoes and some halved cherry tomatoes. And that all heated up makes for a pretty tasty and delicious lunch. So I will be using the rice bowl idea and putting some leftovers into those rice bowls this coming week. It's also interesting to cook maybe some different batches of rice, some basmati rice, some brown rice, maybe black rice or red rice, or other cooked grains, and mixing those together into a pilaf for a little more variety in texture and, of course, better fiber and nutrition. I also tried a little lunchbox pick-me-up of homemade mochi. This is a rice confection. I found a recipe on Food 52's website for plain mochi. It's simply sweet rice flour, sugar, and coconut milk with a little bit of baking powder. And then I use just a little bit of potato starch to coat the pieces to keep them from sticking together. I doubled my recipe and I did take some to Fibercraft Studio for our Saturday tea time. And they went over well. If I were to make them again, I think I would lower my oven temperature even a little more. These cook very low and slow at, I think, 275 degrees for about an hour. I might just reduce that to 250 or 225 and then let the mixture cook longer in the oven. The mochi that I made browned ever so slightly, and it puffs up like a baked good, I guess because of the baking powder in there. But then as it cools, the candy condenses so that it's this very dense, chewy rice paste. I think it's the kind of thing that you either are very attracted to or it doesn't interest you at all. I like it. I like the taste and the texture of mochi, and a little dish of those in my lunchbox made me really look forward to lunchtime, and I had a little pick-me-up in the afternoon. I would not say this is a healthy confection by any means. It has quite a high sugar content, and because it's a candy and I wanted to make sure that the sugar diluted completely in the mixture, I did use white cane sugar. I might try a bit of a reduction in sugar or working with other kinds of sugars in the future. But one of the key features of mochi is this, you know, delicate pale color and texture. And so I think that using organic sugar or turbinado or something would definitely change the color and consistency of the confection. I've put a link to Food 52's recipe in the show notes, and it's something that's very simple. If you double the recipe, it makes quite a quantity that I was able to share and take for lunch for well over a week. So it's worth the investment of your time and a few specialty ingredients. And so forth. Since my last recording, I have sewn my third rendition of the staple dress, a design by April Rhodes. This time I purchased a beautiful cotton lawn by Sarah Watts. The name of the fabric or the print is Mystery Meal. It's a gorgeous feminine pink background and printed with a variety of different octopus shapes. So it kind of blends the ultra feminine and the decidedly weird. I like the print a lot. Again, I use the drop hem version of this pattern. There's also a version with just a straight hem, and I think I will try that next time. It's a very simple pattern, only 5 pieces if you decide to make it without pockets, but I always make mine with pockets. And I've been working each time I sew this pattern, I work to adjust the fit and the shape just a little bit more. I have very long arms and a pretty long waist, so I've been moving the pockets down a little bit. I've been shifting them down each time I sew the pattern so they're at a more comfortable level. I've also been adjusting where I place the elastic for the waistline. And this time I put in bust darts, just not anything incredibly pronounced, but I did try a little bit of bust shaping on the sides of the front piece of the dress. Where I put my bust darts was a little bit low, so when I make this dress again, I will try the bust darts yet again, and I will shift them up about, I guess, an inch to 3/4 of an inch. But doing bust darts meant that I also needed to adjust the length of the front pattern piece so that it would still meet the length of the back pattern piece once I made those bust darts. And I've also been adjusting the sizing of the pattern overall. I don't mind having a generous skirt portion because I think the fullness with the elastic waist is flattering and desirable. And I certainly don't want something tight fitting, especially once you put your hands in your pockets. And that's the point where it's already the widest point of your body. I definitely don't want it to be tight fitting there. But I don't want the top portion of the dress to be too bulky or oversized. And so what I've been doing is shifting to the small, and then in this version of the dress, the lines for the top portion were between the small and the extra small sizes. And then I just gradually brought that out to the medium size for the bottom portion of the dress. I think I've also been getting better at using bias strips of fabric for the neckline and for inside the sleeves. Even though this is a very simple dress, there is great attention to finishing detail. You don't just fold something over and sew it. There's some really nice, I guess, shaping and garment making technique that are used for the neck opening and for the sleeves. And also the shoulder seams have a French seam that makes them very nice and strong and makes them sit nicely on the shoulder. And it's been a lot of fun to make. So I think I will consider a bit of a heavier weight fabric for the next version of this dress and maybe a darker color, more suitable for fall and winter. Even though it is a sleeveless or cap sleeve, I suppose, dress, if you make it a bit roomy on the top, there's certainly room to put a long sleeve t-shirt underneath, and I think that would be a nice casual look for fall. And it's also great for boots and a belt. So I'm contemplating a lot of different looks with the same garment to dress it up, dress it down, wear it with jewelry, coordinate with accessories. And then I think it's suitable for something very plain as well as a wild kind of fabric, like the mystery male print. Kate Pricey, in her introduction, asked if I would speak a little bit about sewing and crafting in a very small space. I know a lot of us are taxed with having a very small space available to us in general in our homes, and then, you know, finding room for storing crafting supplies and also doing some crafting can be a little bit challenging. So when I first started getting really into knitting and crochet, I started to think about storage and workspace a little bit. With knitting, for me, it's more a matter of where to keep supplies. I don't need a great deal of space to do the knitting. I can just sit on a couch or at my table, and you can knit pretty much anywhere. where do you store all this stuff? Where do you put a spinning wheel? And so I started to convert the built-in bookshelves that Samuel and I installed just after we purchased Yinhu into storage space for yarn and fiber, crafting books, and other tools. So each time I wanted to increase my stash or my materials, I needed to sell or give away books that I had stored on my shelves. And that process continues now that I'm also storing some sewing supplies. I've given away a lot of books. I've culled my collection. I keep thinking about what I'm really going to use, things that are out of date, things that I might never read again, or just things that folks I know would probably enjoy. So why keep this on my shelf if I could pass it along to them? And then when I do that, I have a little more room for storing supplies. There's also a shelf, I guess a counter space that runs the entire length of the built-in bookshelves, and I can put lots of larger items on top of that space. But still, I don't like it to look cluttered. I don't like it to look like a storage area. I like things to be organized and aesthetically pleasing, even if they are functioning as storage. Sewing presents a little bit of an additional challenge because you actually need to have a space to work, and things need to stay out for quite some time, like a whole weekend, or maybe you're working on something over the course of a week. So I placed a table. It's a narrow table, but it has very deep leaves upstairs near my office area. So most of the time during the day, it's just a table with a lamp and, you know, some very nice candles and just things that you might have sitting in a calm, pleasing space in your home. But when I'm working on a sewing project, I can open up just one of those leaves, and it's a wide enough workspace that I can put my cutting mat on top. The height isn't optimal. I'm pretty tall, so that does feel like a rather low height for me. I would love it if it were about 6 or 8 inches higher. Still, it's a nice place to work, and then the leaf drops and that is stored out of the way, and then I can just take my cutting mat and I slide it behind my desk. I'm also able to remove all of my usual desktop items to the top of my bookcase, and then I put a very thick folded towel on the top of my desk and I put my sewing machine on top of that. This helps to minimize noise and vibrations, and I also love to use this folded towel as a pin cushion. So as I'm removing pins while I'm sewing, I just stick them into this towel, and I don't have to go looking around, you know, for my pin cushion, because is your pin cushion never where you need it to be? Mine is never where I need it to be. So instead of pins rolling around and dropping on the floor, I just stick them into this folded towel, and then I have this nice stable space for my sewing machine, and you know, it kind of keeps the noise down in case Samuel's working on something somewhere else in the house. My thread, my scissors, measuring tape, just all of the little accessories that you use while you're sewing, I keep in these beautiful cardboard boxes that look like leather-bound books. And I pull them out, I place them on my desk next to the sewing machine. I can close one if I'm not using it. I can stack them up, I can have them open. If I'm following a tutorial, I can set my computer on top of those and have it at eye level so I can follow along with the tutorial. And I really find these cardboard boxes useful. They also store very nicely back on my bookshelves when I put all of my sewing supplies away. So that's the basic setup that I use when I'm sewing, and I tend to organize my time so that I can dedicate several hours to a sewing project, complete it or complete a portion of it, and then put everything away. I know that I rarely get a chance to work on a sewing project on a weekday when I'm working. So I think it would just frustrate me and irritate me and be a big mess if I left all of that out all week knowing I couldn't work on it. But when I'm engaged in something, I want all of my supplies and materials out where I can see them, and I want to be able to immerse myself in the project. So restructuring my office space so that it's a sewing studio is a perfect solution for me. One drawback to this space is that it's not incredibly well lit. In the summer, especially, Yinhu is very dark because it's completely tree covered. There are pretty deep eaves stretching over the windows, and there are many, many windows, but they're quite small. So I don't get any natural light in the summer months, and the lighting that I have is not particularly great. There's a desk lamp I use near my sewing machine when I'm sewing, and it has kind of a swivel neck, so I lift it up and turn it to face my ironing board, which I set up behind my desk when I'm working at the ironing board. But, you know, that's not ideal because it's either lighting up one area or the other, and I'm constantly shifting it back and forth. So I may invest in some additional lighting, or I was also thinking about how I could create a porch setup for sewing. I do have electricity out there, and that maybe I could set myself up outside on the porch for sewing during warmer weather. I'm not sure how that would work with the humidity. I'd have to haul my ironing board down there and everything. But, you know, if you are able to sew for, you know, 6 or 8 hours after having set that up in a way that works, maybe that would be a good investment of time and energy. In any case, I have linked to 2 different project pages on Ravelry with some photos and further explanation of my crafting space. One is a little bit sneaky. It's a hibernating project, but the project is really all photos of Yinhu's interior and exterior and a little bit about the history of the house. The other is I think it was for the Yarniacs podcast. They inspired folks to organize their crafting space, and I took a number of photos of how I had different things organized and explained them. That was all before I received a sewing machine and started sewing again. So I've put some additional photos on the blog post this week. I'd like to welcome the following folks who have introduced themselves on the welcome thread on the Yarns at Yinhu forum on Ravelry. There is Northern Flicker, who is Nancy from Whidbey Island in Puget Sound, Jan Marie Knits from Peabody, Massachusetts, LME Call, who is Linda from Bensalem, Pennsylvania, Cedar Knitter, Lori from Iowa, Peer Pup, who is Jill and a Mountain Knits and Pearls comrade, and her friend Jean 13, who is Jean from Easton, Pennsylvania, Diane Laces, Diane from Galena, Illinois, C.T. Ducklin, who is Linda from Vernon, Connecticut, Yarnder Woman, Melinda from Perth, Australia, and host of the Yarnder Woman podcast, Lori 521, Lori from Maine, Kate Pricey, who has just moved from Melbourne to the UK, Rolling Stone, Rolling from Texas, Nick Fix, who is Nicole from Phoenix, Arizona, NDAK Katie, Kate from Anchorage, Alaska. And finally, Jenny H. Ice, who is Jenny from Hudson, North Carolina. Thanks so much to everyone for their introductions and their very kind words and encouragement about the podcast.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, flowery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves her down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire. Just like Linda Curtis, but out on a wire. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. Music for this episode is So Wheat, music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider liking the show's Facebook page, joining the Yarns at Yin Hu group on Ravelry, or leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.